From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Jared Nolan.
And I'm Sam Hirschman.
This week on War News Radio, New Voices, we hear from journalists who starred with War News Radio this year.
First, we learn about the role of Chinese investment in Afghanistan.
Then, we speak with an Afghan journalist who studied at Swarthmore College.
American colleges are known throughout the world. We have the best, teaching and education system. My whole aim, while at Swarthmore and studying at Swarthmore was to return back to Afghanistan and work in the government or in other institutions so I can contribute directly to the Afghan people.
Finally, we learn about the Raymond Davis case and the implications of Islamic and secular law.
This is War News Radio. A 2010 report by the U.S. Geological Survey and the Pentagon reported that Afghanistan may contain nearly $1 trillion worth of untapped mineral deposits. This mineral wealth has the potential to transform the country, and foreign investors are eager to exploit this investment opportunity. Caroline Batten has more on one specific country's involvement, China. This piece first aired in April.
Since Afghanistan's economy opened up to foreign investment in 2008, China invested nearly $3 billion in the Aynak copper mine, described by a British-Afghan geological survey team as the largest undeveloped copper mine in the world. Developing Aynak, along with other Chinese development projects, could lead to a large influx of capital into the country. But what is China's motivation behind investing?
Infrastructure requires copper. If you look at the need it for piping, you need it for electricity, you need it for a light rail system. It's an extremely valuable element in that it conducts electricity very well, and that's what the Chinese need to develop their infrastructure.
That was James R. Yeager, former consultant to the Afghan Ministry of Mines and Industry, speaking about the motivation behind Chinese investment in the Aynak copper field. But Afghanistan is ideal for Chinese investment in many ways beyond its rich mineral resources. Raffaello Pantucci is a journalist, think tank researcher, and associate fellow at the International Center for the Study of Radicalization, and explains Afghanistan's unique position as a local, undeveloped, mineral-rich nation.
A lot of it's sort of untapped potential. I mean, Afghanistan's been unavailable to people to explore for a very long time. So on the one hand, it's a sort of big untapped place, and China needs lots of raw materials at this point. So clearly it looks to countries where it can get these things or where they haven't been exploited yet. This is why we see China in vast swathes of Africa as well. But then, of course, with Afghanistan sits on its border. It's right next door. So it has the added sort of bonus of being convenient for them.
China also has indirect economic benefits from a developed Afghanistan.
China has out to its west, there's a very big province called Xinjiang, which is one of China's sort of least developed provinces. And so China in part hopes that by developing the sort of immediate periphery, you have the added advantage of having effective developing your own area.
However, the benefits go both ways. Pantucci suggests that development could create real benefits for the Afghan economy.
In many ways, is that a bad thing? I've certainly heard that with the case of Africa, in some of these poor African countries, I know there's a growing consensus amongst sort of the Western diplomatic community and the Western aid community that it may be the case that the Chinese are sort of coming in and doing these deals and bribing people and undercutting Western sort of companies. But you know what? They're getting roads built in countries where there weren't roads before, and that's going to help the sort of general situation. And I would suspect that this is probably quite similar for Afghanistan.
But Yeager explains that not everyone is convinced that Chinese investment is necessarily a good thing for Afghanistan.
For every direct job in mining, 10 indirect jobs are created, and that's suppliers of the indirect job. The problem with the Chinese investment, it's all vertically integrated. Everything will come from China, and you won't have the second tier of the secondary jobs developing in Afghanistan. You know, it's a wait and see. If they really live up to their contract and provide jobs for the people, and the money, in fact, gets back to the people, then it's a good deal. If, in fact, no jobs are created and they bring in their Chinese labor like has happened in the past, then it's just terrible for Afghanistan.
Nevertheless, the underlying political questions regarding foreign investment remain. Pantucci explains the dilemma.
There is the question of the political optics of what it looks like for a Chinese company to sort of sweep in and make money out of a situation where, you know, NATO forces have sort of fought and died. But that's a sort of political thing. I think in the sort of longer run, people would probably look at this picture and say, well, you know, someone's developing somewhere that wasn't developed.
China Metallurgical Group Corporation, or MCC, is the primary investor in the Einak copper mine. Yeager states that Chinese companies like MCC have economic advantages that U.S. or European countries do not.
MCC is 44% owned by the Chinese government. They do not have to be accountable to investors or their boards of directors. If a Western company were to develop Einak, they would have to seek outside investment from finance companies to the tune of $1 billion and would have to be accountable for that money to the investors as well as to their board of directors.
But, as Pantucci tells us, some of these advantages may come from policies that most companies keep under wraps.
Chinese companies may be less hindered by requirements in terms of bribing foreign ministers. I know with previous deals, there was the famous Einak copper mine that the Chinese purchased. There have been all sorts of rumors about the size of the bribe that the Chinese company was able to hand over to the Minister of Mines. And I've heard people say jokingly that other contracts have been held up because they were waiting for the Chinese company to arrive with its bribe. Now, this is all rumor and speculation. But, you know, I know that certainly for Western companies, these things are more difficult than there is maybe.
Ultimately, China's political stances will be guided by its close ally, Pakistan. Pakistan and China are allies due to their mutual rivalry with India, as both have fought separate wars with India.
One has to remember that really China sees this country politically through Pakistan, which is, you know, its greatest and oldest friend. Basically, if you want to look at sort of how the relationship between Iran and Afghanistan will play out in geopolitical terms, you probably need you're better looking at what happens with Pakistan is choosing to do. And at the moment, Pakistan seems to be playing a slightly hedging game in this situation. And so the Chinese are sort of following that lead because one day, and who knows when it'll be, probably quite soon, America will start leaving Afghanistan. And they're uncertain that Afghanistan and the political scene as it is there now is necessarily going to survive. So their concern is the Taliban are someone to come back in power, so they're not going to aggravate the situation. They're not going to get too involved in the internal politics of Afghanistan unless their Pakistani friends call them to do it or ask them to do it.
China continues to aggressively pursue investment opportunities in Afghanistan, most notably the Haji Gak iron field, billed by the Afghan Ministry of Mines as potentially the largest undeveloped iron ore deposit in Asia. A recently WikiLeaked U.S. State Department cable noted that if successful in the Haji Gak bid, China will become Afghanistan's largest foreign investor. For War News Radio, with Aaron Moser and Alan Zhao, I'm Caroline Batt.
This is War News Radio. According to the Afghan Ministry of Higher Education, their university system still struggles with chronic shortages of funds, infrastructure, and teachers, and many Afghan students choose to pursue degrees abroad. From 2006 to 2010, Rahala Kalapowak attended Swarthmore College, War News Radio's parent organization. In this piece, first aired in February, Colin Smith talked to him about his experiences in the United States.
Could you just tell us who you are?
My name is Ruhullah. I'm from Afghanistan. I finished my high school studies here in Afghanistan, but had the opportunity to come to the United States in 2006. Swarthmore generously awarded me scholarship, full scholarship. Studied there for 4 years. I majored in Middle Eastern studies and returned back to Afghanistan right after my graduation with Swarthmore.
Why did you come to the U.S.?
You know, American colleges are known throughout the world. We have the best, you know, teaching and education system. My whole aim, you know, while I experience so I can contribute directly to the Afghan people.
How did you get the opportunity to study in the United States?
When I finished my high school in 2001, Afghanistan was invaded by the U.S. As soon as the Taliban left the country in 2001, I joined media organization or journalists who came to Afghanistan to cover the war. I started with Time magazine first, working there with fixer, translator, and a guide. After that, I was hired by the New York Times. So I worked until 2006 before I leave for America with the New York Times. Basically, I was here in Afghanistan working for the New York Times, and I saw the opportunity that New York Times is also an American newspaper. It will be more possible to go to America than any other country because most of the journalists are Americans. And so I tried, and they convinced me to apply to different colleges. So I applied to probably, I think, 5 or 6 colleges throughout the East Coast of the United States. Swarthmore was very generous, and they awarded me a full scholarship.
What was Swarthmore College like?
It was very tough, but also at the same time, a lot of fun. I had good friends and very good time in the 4 years I was there. Though in the beginning, it was very difficult for me. I had to adjust to, the culture as well as adjust to the educational system. But Swarthmore was very helpful. A lot of my professors, they gave me a lot of their time to explain things and help me out to adjust to the system.
How are you perceived as an Afghan here in America?
Yeah, I was worried about this. I used to hear, some people were saying in America you would be treated differently, and I used to hear a lot of this before I leave for America in 2006. But it was completely different, Swarthmore, the people, the educated people, they were very, very nice and actually very interested to talk to me, which I was surprised, what I was hearing before, but what I was seeing at the time when I was there. People were very, very nice and very friendly to me. I never, in the whole 4 years, I never had any problems or I felt like I was looked upon different there. But I was treated very well.
So how is an American education valued by Afghans?
Definitely. If you speak English, that's the most preferred, person, to be hired by anyone. The countries that are involved in Afghanistan, their main language is English. But if you have a degree from the United States, you would be able to get a good job pretty fast.
As an Afghan who has seen America, what are your thoughts on the American occupation of your country?
Well, I think, Afghanistan is different than the Middle East. A lot of Middle Eastern countries, they have their own resources to gain and stand on their own feet. Afghanistan was very much destroyed infrastructure, and our economy is very, very low and compared to a lot of others. And I think there is a need for America to remain here and help the Afghan people to stand on their own feet and stabilize their country. We know everything, September 11th, it happened from here, and Americans in America have committed to bring stability and peace to this country. So we'll see.
Rahul currently lives in Kandahar, Afghanistan, and continues to work at the Afghan news desk of the New York Times. For War News Radio, with Alan Zhao, I'm Colin Smith.
This is War News Radio. Raymond Davis, a CIA contract worker, was released from a Pakistani prison after being charged with double homicide and spending nearly 3 months in captivity. Though the U.S. government argued that Davis should have been released because he was an embassy employee with diplomatic immunity, his release was ultimately brought about by a promise of monetary compensation. Alan Zhao and John McMinn looked into how diplomacy and Sharia law interacted throughout this crisis in this piece first aired in April. Here's John.
With respect to Mr. Davis, our diplomat in Pakistan, we've got a very simple principle here, that every country in the world that is party to the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations has upheld in the past and should uphold in the future. And that is, if our diplomats are in another country, then they are not subject to that country's local prosecution. We respect it with respect to diplomats who are here. We expect Pakistan, that's a signatory, and recognize Mr. Davis as a diplomat, to abide by this same convention. You know, for those who aren't familiar with the background on this, a couple of Pakistanis were killed in a incident between Mr. Davis in Pakistan. So obviously we're concerned about the loss of life. You know, we're not callous about that. But there's a broader principle at stake that I think we have to uphold.
Over the past several months, the saga of Raymond Davis revealed just how strained U.S.-Pakistani relations truly are. Pakistan has long served as an essential ally in the fight against the Taliban. The U.S. sent billions of dollars in military and economic aid since 2001 in exchange for Pakistani cooperation in hunting down the Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces. In recent years, the U.S. increased drone missile strikes in the Pakistani tribal regions to target Taliban and Al-Qaeda operatives who have been using the areas as a safe haven. Such strikes are extremely unpopular in Pakistan, causing Pakistani officials to publicly condemn the attacks, even if privately allowing such operations. On January 27, 2011, an incident involving an American named Raymond Davis left two men dead in Lahore, Pakistan, setting off a diplomatic crisis. Though U.S. officials maintained that Davis was an employee of the U.S. Embassy, Western media sources identified him as a former U.S. Special Forces soldier and Blackwater employee under contract with the CIA. Making matters worse, a car dispatched by the U.S. to assist Davis struck and killed an additional civilian. The U.S. strongly pressured the Pakistani government to hand over Davis, arguing that as an embassy employee, he was protected by diplomatic immunity. Professor John Quigley from the Mort School of Law at Ohio State University explains more about how the concept of diplomatic immunity functions and why so much is at stake in determining the exact nature of Davis's employment at the U.S. Embassy.
Well, in general, persons who hold diplomatic posts are considered immune from the jurisdiction of local courts, meaning that they can't be sued by anyone there. They can't be prosecuted criminally, you know, even if they commit, you know, multiple murders, they can't be prosecuted. And the idea for that is to ensure that the sending state, in the jargon of diplomatic law, is able to carry out its functions in the receiving state without impediments from the side of the receiving state. That immunity applies not only to those who are what one ordinarily thinks of as diplomats, and the term that's used is administrative and technical personnel. And in the Raymond Davis situation, the United States eventually claimed that he was in that category of administrative and technical personnel.
However, as Dr. Quigley explains, not all foreign officials qualify.
Another possibility is that he was connected with the consulate in Lahore, in which case he probably would not enjoy diplomatic immunity because consular officials are not immune from prosecution.
The Pakistani government hesitated to grant Davis diplomatic immunity due to allegations that he was connected to covert CIA operations, which remain a highly contentious issue inside Pakistan. However, Professor Quigley reveals that such covert operations are not entirely at odds with normal diplomatic procedures.
If the United States is sending people into Pakistan in this situation, doing things that it's not informing Pakistan about, then it's very questionable as to whether that's appropriate diplomatic activity. Now, it is true that one of the traditional functions of embassies is information collection about the receiving state. So to a certain degree, that is accepted in the international community. And even if the person is an employee of the CIA, covertly, if he in fact has been accepted as administrative and technical personnel, then he would enjoy diplomatic immunity.
How the case would have played out in Pakistani civil court will never be known, since Davis was released mid-trial after nearly 3 months of imprisonment. Despite the initial focus on diplomatic rights, the monetary settlement given to the victims' families caused some to wonder if the U.S. considered Sharia law or Islamic law in resolving the case. Tariq Al-Jamil, an associate professor of religion and Islamic studies at Swarthmore College, Warner's Radio's parent organization, explains the history of Sharia law in Pakistan.
Even at the very founding of Pakistan, it was controversial among some circles as to how much Sharia law would be a part of the new constitutional system. And there have been efforts made over the past 60 or so years to, in fact, increase the degree of Sharia present in the government. And, of course, there's been an equal pushback against it.
In 2009, the Pakistani government agreed to a controversial peace deal with Taliban leaders, allowing Sharia law to be enforced in the Taliban-controlled Swat Valley. On a local level, Sharia law is becoming more of a reality throughout certain areas in northern Pakistan. For Davis, relief came only after a local judge acquitted him once all 11 members of the victims' families agreed to pardon him, following secret negotiations between U.S. and Pakistani officials that resulted in a promise of $2.4 million in blood money to the families.
The term itself is a dia or diat. The heirs of a victim would be compensated in some way as an alternative to forms of punishments that were prevalent in the pre-Islamic period, in which the family would seek retribution, in this case, life for life.
But applying Islamic law, like diyat, to foreigners is a much more complicated concept, as Sharia law tends to prescribe solutions between individuals rather than countries.
The compensation tends to be structured around a person's personal status in relationship to Islam. So there's no general principle about how to deal with foreigners, but it's based upon one's relationship to Islam, at least in the Sharia.
The Davis case presented a new set of hurdles for U.S. officials who are accustomed to dealing directly with Pakistani officials, where the U.S. can traditionally flex its diplomatic muscles. Dr. Quigley explains more.
The whole system of diplomatic immunity is based on the notion of reciprocity, and I think it's based on an assumption of equality among states, which in fact does not exist. The power relationship is often quite relevant. The United States can typically get away with more in this realm than, say, Pakistan could if it had operatives in the United States.
The public outcry in Pakistan surrounding the Davis case limited the U.S.'s ability to apply its diplomatic power to achieve its goals, causing the U.S. to operate through alternative Sharia channels. Dr. Al-Jamil describes the potential benefits of operating through Sharia channels.
It does point to an example of how the Sharia can actually solve a conflict that is much more challenging in a kind of constitutional-based governmental system that is not Sharia-based. But this case, I think, highlights that, mm-hmm. where the idea of simply paying retribution was probably better than the kind of holding him in the long period of trial and so forth that he would have faced if he remained in the Pakistani legal system.
The debate about the role of Sharia law in Islamic societies continues. In the Davis case, the U.S. interacted with the Sharia practices of Pakistan when traditional diplomatic power relations failed in the face of public outcry throughout the nation. For Al-Jamil, the importance of Sharia law makes it a potentially useful tool for U.S. diplomats given its importance in the region, but the current understanding of Sharia is misrepresented by the Taliban stereotypes.
And we see a kind of very crude representation of Sharia-based principles among extremist groups, like the Taliban and others, who would have a very, very narrow idea of what constitutes the Sharia. In many ways, they are similar to some of the detractors coming from America, the Americas, and Europe, in that they both have a very, very narrow perception of what constitutes the Sharia.
But the specific issues in the Davis case are only a small part in a much larger debate over covert operations in Pakistan. Dr. Quigley suggests that the use of diplomatic law to protect covert operations may ultimately be counterproductive in the long run for the U.S.
It probably does harm the United States substantially that we are engaging in this kind of activity. I mean, you can see the reaction that's come about in Pakistan to this situation. And these kinds of incidents, of course, occur against the whole background of colonialism. And I mean, even if the United States, you know, was not itself a colonial power in Pakistan, that probably doesn't matter too much in terms of the local perception. And I think that we run a great risk of anti-American terrorism coming out of this kind of activity. How much good it does, that is, if you want to do a cost-benefit analysis, I'm not sure where that comes down. I tend to think we're probably doing more harm than good.
While the Davis case has technically been resolved through the settlement with the Pakistani families, the uproar over U.S. operations in Pakistan continues. Last week, the New York Times reported that top of Pakistani officials had demanded a limit to the number of covert operatives in Pakistan and a halt to drone strikes. This comes after Pakistanis continue to protest the U.S. role in their nation and the rising number of civilian casualties connected to U.S. operations. This week, U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, met with Pakistani officials in an attempt to ease tensions between the two nations. However, following the meeting, Mullen accused the Pakistani intelligence service of maintaining ties with the Taliban inside Pakistan. Pakistani officials adamantly deny the accusation, calling it negative propaganda, as relations show no sign of improving. For War News Radio, I'm John McMinn.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Sam Hirschman.
And I'm Jared Nolan. Until next time, thanks for listening.